Welcome back to the Modern Wool Podcast, brought to you by Abundant Earth Fiber. We're here to share the secrets of sustainable small batch yarn straight from our mill on Whidbey Island. I'm Lydia Christiansen. Thanks so much for listening. You're listening to episode 5. In this episode, I'm going to let you in on some secrets behind one of our top-selling yarns, Joseph and Annie. I'm going to fill you in on how the yarn came to be, a bit about the Targhee sheep breed, and also you'll hear some stories about one of the local farms where we get the wool. Further, I just want to thank so many of you out there. First of all, for listening to this podcast, and second of all, for encouraging me to make more episodes. So many of you have reached out through social sites, through email, and also in person to let me know that you appreciate the podcast and you want to hear more. And when is the next episode going to be? So, yay, it's here. This is the next episode, and we fully intend on making more and keeping this going. But the elephant in the room question is, where have we been? Why haven't we recorded an episode in so long? And I do believe I have a very good reason for that. To those of you here in the Pacific Northwest, this probably does not come as a surprise. But for those of you out there who are not in the area, you might not have heard this. We have built something that we're calling the Fiber Lab. It has taken every last bit of my family, my husband and I, and our family's energy and time and to build this place. But we had the opportunity arise late last spring, and we just couldn't say no. So we have 3,000 square feet now dedicated to the Fiber Lab, and it's like a fiber arts community center, really. There's a knitting lounge, and we serve some locally roasted coffee and hot tea Friday, Saturday. You can pop in and knit with us. We have a spinning studio. We have floor looms that are pre-warped. If somebody wants to just come in off the street, throw the shuttle a few times, that's encouraged. We have a needle felting station, and we even have a dye bar. Have you ever heard of a dye bar in a yarn shop before? We have developed wool tinctures, which are a very quick and easy way to dye yarn at home without any mess. And it's really fast and easy. And so we've set up a station at the Fiber Lab where you can either bring your yarn out of your stash that you want to fix up or purchase yarn in the store and we'll dye it for you. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes at the most, and you could take it home with you. So a custom dye bar at the Fiber Lab. It's so fun. Of course, we also have staff who can answer your questions and help you move forward with your projects and keep them going. We have routine classes in knitting, hand spinning, weaving, and I would like to have more and more as we develop and grow. But the vision behind the Fiber Lab is that this is a place for all ages and abilities to explore fiber arts and try something new or just relax and enjoy the space. The greatest compliment that we have had about the Fiber Lab is simply that, wow, it feels good in here. It's so much more than just a retail shop. It's so much more than just yarn. It's actual time and space carved out of this crazy world to just be together with people you like, doing things you like. So we kind of love it. If you're in the area and you haven't checked out the Fiber Lab, or if you're thinking about visiting Whidbey, please stop by. We have, of course, we sell all of our yarns and rovings there, and also some local artisan products, as well as a huge selection of spin cycle yarns. In case you didn't know, we actually make two product lines now for spin cycle. We spin at our mill versus the spin cycle gals do the dyeing and they send us the fiber and then we do the spinning for all of Versus and now Metamorphic, the newest release by Spin Cycle is a 50-50 blend of, it's all U.S. wool. Half of it is recycled wool from their mill, the little scraps that come off their machines and stuff. I have turned it into yarn and I make that for them. I'm so proud of it and I love that yarn. So anyway, next time you're in the area, please stop by the Fiber Lab. And let me tell you, I'm very excited to get this podcast back up and running. There's so much I want to share and talk about, and so much also happening in the Fiber Lab that we can share here now too. Creating this sense of community has been a long time dream for us, and we just couldn't be more thrilled to see all these different pieces coming together. We care so much about the community among us of producers, processors, and handcrafters who value high-quality small-batch yarn. Okay, there's one teeny tiny little last thing I need to follow up with you on before we dive into Joseph and Andy and the Targhee sheep breed. Listen, guys, I was at the bagel shop here on Whidbey picking up bagels for my family, and somebody I brushed shoulders with turned around and said, "Oh my God, I've been listening to your podcast. And you know what? I do have wool in my closet." And then she laughed and, you know, walked away, walked away. I couldn't be happier to have such a random wool encounter in the wild. That was so fantastic. Made my day. And all of you who have reached out to tell me that listening to our episode on scouring, which was episode 3, has given you courage to get that wool out and try washing it. And I've even seen some of the wool that has been washed. I'm just so proud of you all. And thank you for listening. Thank you for stashing wool. Thank you for trying your hand at scouring. And keep them coming. I love hearing about it all. And I just wanted to thank you for getting into it. And on the topic of scouring, I just had to tell you one of the coolest things happened at the Fiber Lab just a couple weeks ago. A local fourth grader came to interview me about scouring because she's doing her science fair project on washing wool. How cool is that? She asked great questions. She's got it all planned out. She's washing a variety of different breeds and a few different ways. And I was just so thrilled to see her taking this on and making this a part of her science fair project. How cool is that? Okay, so any kids out there looking for science projects, how about scouring wool? Start with episode 3. If you appreciate the Modern Wool Podcast, help us make more episodes by sharing it with your friends on social or in your knitting groups. Subscribe to us anywhere you get your podcrafts. Podcasts. And also, I understand this is pretty important, but if you really want to make a difference, give us a rating on iTunes so that we start showing up in more searches. When people go looking for great podcasts about yarn or wool, they'll find us. The more people who review us, the more people will find us. Okay, let's get into Joseph and Annie. We named a yarn after Joseph and Annie Albers. Joseph and Annie, it's one of our favorite yarns, and a lot of people who are not familiar with the Albers will look at the name for the yarn and think that it's the name of the sheep. It's not the name of the sheep. I named this after Joseph and Annie Albers, who really inspired me in the making of this yarn. There's an actual story behind how I designed this yarn, how it came to be, and why we make it the way we do with the type of wool that we do. So this is the story of Joseph and Annie yarn, but let me begin by telling you about Joseph and Annie Albers. Joseph and Annie Albers studied at the Bauhaus School in Germany pre-World War II. That is where they met. I believe that's where, during the time frame where they got married as well. And this couple left Germany just before the war, came to the United States, and spent the rest of their lives here in the States. They were dedicated artists and designers, and they were very influential in changing the way artists think about design and designers think about art. Annie spent a lot of her artistic career in weaving and in paper printmaking, and also has some jewelry. Her designs are iconic. And Joseph, they both were also educators as well. And Joseph wrote a book called Interaction of Color. And when I think about Joseph Albers, I can't not think about this book. I picked it up for a flight. I can't even remember now where I was flying, but sat down on my flight, opened this book, and I could not put it down. I finished the book before the flight ended, and it has left an indelible mark on my mind about color. His main concept in this book, Interaction of Color, my takeaway at least, I mean, to each their own, but my takeaway from the book was color is meaningful in context. It's relative to the person perceiving it and to the context that it's in. Okay, so hold that thought. That's going to come back later. I'm going to step aside now from Joseph and Annie Albers and tell you a little bit about this yarn that I wanted to make. When we opened our mill and I started making these, it was thrilling and scary and terrifying, and it was terribly difficult because I barely knew what I was doing, but just so thrilling. And I felt really drawn to making yarn in such a way, and I still feel this way, but making yarn in such a way that benefited the people producing the wool, the farmers. And one of the things that I had gotten to know about our local family farms producing wool is that a lot of them have colored sheep. Sheep grow wool in colors other than white. And you see that in the small flock level, where you don't normally see that in the large range flocks. Because their wool, the large range flocks, are going to industrial processing lines, and they have to be white for that purpose. But at the small flock level, you get to really see the rainbow of colors that sheep produce. And that was one of the things in the beginning that I was really drawn to and fascinated by. And I started making breed-specific yarns in natural colors. Browns and grays and taupes and rose grays and fawn and mahogany. I love that. That's an alpaca color. That's my favorite alpaca color, mahogany. Anyway, I would take these yarns with us to shows, to events where I could sell them. And I was kind of frustrated because although there is a strong interest for breed-specific yarns, at the time, at least, it felt like it was a novelty interest. It wasn't the mainstay everyday knitter interest. Those customers were looking for merino, 9 times out of 10, looking for merino. And so I went home with this sort of like conflict in my mind about how do I serve this customer base who wants to knit soft, squishy, round sweater yarn, and also serve my community and express something colorful, something naturally colorful in the yarn that I make. Well, it was around the time when I was struggling with that conflict that I read Joseph's book, Interaction of Color. And the concept of expressing color in a context really resonated with me. And so suddenly it wasn't like, I need to go out and buy a natural colored fleece and make it into a 100% pure yarn. Then I suddenly felt like I could go out and get this natural colored fleece, blend it with this merino that the knitters want, but in such a way that it stands out and it pops out and it tells a story just by contrast. And so I credit Joseph Albers for really inspiring me to think about making yarn in this way. And the first batch that I made, it wasn't called Joseph and Annie. It was called something else. And it flew. As soon as it hit the shelves, it was gone. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm onto something here. And I tried another batch. And I think looking back in my records, there was at least 12 different iterations of how to create a color contrast that makes sense to knitters and that is beautiful and that expresses this natural color from our local farms. And by the time we got to that iteration, we were selling so much of it and producing repeat batches, it needed a name. And the name that I came up with was Joseph and Annie. All of the wool we use to spin Joseph and Annie is raised in the United States. And the natural color comes from family farms that we have a personal relationship with. In the beginning, it all came from one farm. And I'm going to get to that farm later. I'm going to tell you about Glengyle Farm, Dale and Elaine Wilson. But the demand for the yarn and the amount of skeins that we were producing increased beyond what that one farm could produce. So now we do work with more than one farm to get the natural colored wool that we need. But they're all farms that we have personal relationships with. And to us, that's really what the definition of local is. It's about relationships. It's about being in close contact with people that you know and trust. And it helps us feel like we know exactly what goes into our skeins from farm to yarn. For as long as we have been spinning Joseph and Annie yarn, our customers have been asking for us to make it in a DK weight. Let me tell you, Joseph and Annie is a sport weight yarn, which I have heard has been knit as a fingering and also as a heavier weight. And I don't really see it for myself going into a heavier gauge, but it's got range. That's what I'm saying. We call it a sport weight. It's a 3-ply. And there are a generous 360 yards in each skein. They're 100 gram skeins. As long as we've been spinning in this yarn, people have been asking for us to make it in a DK weight, or do we have this natural speckle in a DK? And honestly, it's something I've always wanted to do. I just haven't been able, you know, with time and energy and space and everything like that to make it happen until now. It is finally here. You are the first to hear about it. We have now made our Joseph and Annie yarn into a DK weight batch. This is a special batch because I don't think that I can call the DK weight yarn Joseph and Annie. I think it needs a new name, but I don't know what to call it yet. I haven't decided. We're sure that it's going to stay. We're going to keep producing it. And so now I'm in this phase where we have a new yarn born and we want to share it with you. And we want your help to name it. Give us some ideas and solutions. There's no rush. We're not even ready to release this batch into the wild. It will be available, okay, write this down. It'll be available on February 29th, Leap Day at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That is when the Joseph and Annie DK weight batch is going to be available on our website only. You can't get it in person at the Fiber Lab. You have to get it online. We can't wait to share this batch with you. And please, if you can get your hands on some of this yarn, once you see it, feel it, touch it, work with it, give us some inspiration on what to call it, please. We'll put a little survey on the website that you can drop in your suggestions. So that's the story behind the yarn design. What about the story behind the wool? The natural color speckle in Joseph and Annie comes from a breed of sheep called Targi. The merino in the yarn is white, and the Targi is spun in two different shades. It's either a warm cinnamon, we call it, or a cool pepper. Most of the natural colored fleeces that we can get will fall into one of those categories. So that's why we have done it that way, warm and cool. And each lot has a slightly different effect. And so rather than calling it a dye lot, we call it a fleece lot. So what about these fleeces? Let me tell you about the Targi breed of sheep. First of all, let me tell you about three of the sources that I used for information. So if you want to go deeper, you certainly can. The first is the website for the U.S. Targi Sheep Association. Targi is a breed that was developed in the United States So this is the site tied to the origins of the breed. This is the authority on the breed, the U.S. Targhee Sheep Association. Also, my favorite book, The Fleece and Fiber Source Book by Deborah Obson and Carol Icarius, tipped me off to an interesting side story, which I'll get to later. And also, the Oklahoma State University website has a sheep directory. Apparently, they're amazing. If you like the Fleece and Fiber Source Book, you're going to love this sheep directory at the Oklahoma State University website. Loads of information in there, and I could have easily spent hours and hours just browsing sheep breeds. So Oklahoma State, probably my new favorite website. Okay, so Targhee sheep, whenever you want to, you know, try to understand the origins of a sheep breed, it's all about genetics. It's all about tracing back the heritage of the genetic lines in the sheep. And that is a whole conversation, you know, breeding, that concept of breeding animals. Let's just pin that and save that for another time. Okay. Sheep and humans have a long-standing relationship, and breeding four different attributes is a part of that relationship. So let's just pin that part of the conversation and focus on what the Targhee sheep breed is, where it came from, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? This story begins in the late 19th century. It's important to recognize the context of life at that time was very different than it is today. And one of the things that was different in shepherds' relationship with keeping sheep, back then it was primarily about wool. Today, it is primarily about meat. That is a major shift that has happened in that amount of time. Back then, it was, like I said, primarily about the wool. And so there was a lot of research and development going into the genetics of really great wool. And so on the one hand, we are benefiting from that today. On the other hand, no, there is no other hand. We benefit from it. Okay, so it was widely believed that the best all-purpose, all-around sheep would have attributes from both a fine wool breed and a long wool breed. So the development of Corriedale, which is a cross between Lincoln and Merino, was established, I believe, in the late 19th century in New Zealand. And around the same time, the Columbia breed was established here in the United States by crossing Lincoln and Rambouillet. Merino and Rambouillet are very similar in the type of like soft, fine wool fiber. And so the Corriedale and the Columbia can be considered very similar breeds, but different, and they were established on different continents. All right, from that development, shepherds began to think that a two-thirds fine wool, one-quarter long wool was an even better breed of sheep. And this is where the term comeback comes from. A comeback sheep is not a breed of sheep. It's a style of breeding. It's taking this 50-50 long wool, fine wool, something like a Corriedale or Columbia, and then breeding that offspring back to a Merino or a Rambouillet, something fine. So the offspring's genetics have three parts fine wool and one part long wool. So that's the concept that initiated research into the Targhee breed. It wasn't called the Targhee breed at that time that they started researching it. In 1926, 210 Corriedale and Columbia sheep were established at the Du Bois, Idaho research station. And they were established for a research project to find out if breeding them back to high-quality Rambouillet rams would produce a better sheep. Well, that research took place, And by about 1938, it was widely accepted that, yeah, this was an incredible sheep. In fact, this guy named Henry Yopp, I don't know if I'm saying that right, Y-O-P-P-E. 3 years after the research station started this project, he took it upon himself to do the same at his own ranch. So Henry Yopp in 1929 started breeding his Corriedale and Columbias and similar ranch stock to fine wool. I believe it was Rambouillet. And then in 1934, he bought a Targhee ram from the research station and continued his development that way. In 1938, he was able to start selling them, and they were very popular. And that kind of was the tipping point where the research was acknowledged as a success, and they started to expand and really develop the project further. So what happened during the 40s, the following decade, was that other ranchers started doing what Henry was doing and got behind this breeding concept and doing the same thing that the research station had been doing with their ranch stock, breeding them to either fine Rambouillets or actual Targhees that they had purchased from the research station or from Henry Yopp. Okay, a decade past that, in 1951, 17 people got together. I think it was like in the spring, May or something like that. And they got 17 people got together to talk about this new breed and a step possibly establishing it as a breed. Approximately a year later, in February of 1952, the first official Targhee registration took place, where 34 Targhees from Montana State University were registered as the first official Targhee sheep. Other Targhees were added to the registry, but by 1966, they closed the book on those original registrations. So what that means is, I do not have a background in breeding sheep or in farming. So I'm understanding all of this through my research, but also in conversations that I've had with ranchers. I have a secondhand knowledge to how this works. And I know there's a lot of you out there who understand it better than I do. But my understanding is that when the books close, in order for your sheep to be a registered Targhee today, they have to be offspring of some sheep from that book. So all subsequent registered Targhees are offspring of those original registrations between 1952 and 1966. Okay, that's where the Targhee breed came from. And circling back to why did they do it, I kind of glossed over it because what I said was they were trying to find if it made a better sheep. What is better? You know, there's lots of different reasons why people would have sheep. What they were looking for specifically, good health, hardiness for the climate. Also, good mothering is a huge benefit in a flock of sheep. Dense, heavy wool production. And soft, fine wool that can be used in next to skin cloth. Well, that is the exact description of Targhees today. The average sheep, give or take, depending on whether it's a ram or a ewe, is about 200 pounds. The average fleece is between 10 and 15 pounds. It's very generous. Average staple length of the fiber is between 3 and 5 inches. And you can expect a yield on this wool between 50 and 55%. As far as micron, the breed standards, according to the Targhee Sheep Association, is 21 to 25 micron. That's the perfect range. If you're into microns, I mean, come on, am I wrong? That is the perfect range for a fine wool. And if you translated that to spinning counts, that's the 64s to 58s. The count systems is a whole topic that I would love to get into with you. It's complicated. It's messy. It's a big tangled web because there are so many different count systems. But let's save that for another episode. So in summary, the Targhee sheep are a specific breed that have both long wool roots, but are mostly fine wool attributes. They're hardy and strong, and their wool is just divine, and they grow a lot of it. So it's no surprise that they are very common now in the American West, as well as Canada. And we have a lot of Targhee here in Washington State, particularly on the eastern side of the state where it's not so wet. Now, according to the Targhee Sheep Association, all Targhees are white. But we're using a natural color Targhee in our yarn. So what's up with that? According to breed standards, which is a whole political concept, okay? According to breed association standards, it's white because it's meant to be a range sheep. And range sheep are typically used in industrial processing lines. So in order for this wool to be sold at the best price, give the farmers back the best yield for their labor, white is the standard. And from the people that I've talked to who tend Targhee on the range, colored sheep are, it's like demerits. And also, they don't really know what to do with those black lambs and those color, and when colored wool pops up. Well, hand spinners, guys, hand spinners love it. And that is where our small flocks have, and small family farms have the upper hand in selling wool to hand spinners, because producing colored wool is not seen as demerit. It's nuance and it's diversity and it's beautiful. So incidentally, the Targhee that we use, they are not registered Targhees because they're colored, but they are Targhee in the sense that I'm talking about the original farm that we started buying from. They bought the Targhee rams and ewes from the Du Bois Research Station and bred them to their natural colored Corriedales. So they already had color in their flock, and then they bred in the Targhee from the research station. So, you know, some people might look at it and be like, well, it's not Targhee because it's colored. Technically, right, they are not registered. But if you understand what the breed is and how this particular flock came to be, then what else would it be called? It's Targhee. So, hey, guys, words have a lot of different meanings. You know, let's go easy on each other and look at things from different points of view. And it's okay to understand the same word in more than one way. Oh, hey, I've got another little interesting tidbit that's not specifically about the breed, but it's got a tie-in. I think it's kind of interesting. Knowing that those first registered Targhees came from Montana State University, I went over to their website to see what they might have and how what their connection might be. I didn't find a whole lot on Targhee sheep per se, other than I found out that the U.S. Targhee Sheep Association has a Hall of Fame. Who knew? I didn't know. And the way I found out is through an article that described, and this was in 2005, that was describing three new inductees into the Targhee Sheep Association Hall of Fame: Rodney Cott, Verl Thomas, and Carolyn Green. These are all three people from Montana. And I had to read on, because if you get inducted into a Hall of Fame for sheep, I need to know why. And it turns out these were just Rodney, Verl has passed on, so I shouldn't say were. Rodney and Carolyn are still alive. Amazing people, and of course have dedicated themselves in their own ways to the Targhee sheep breed. And I'm just fascinated to read their stories, and I'm not going to get all into it right here, but certainly you could dig into that further if you want to. But the reason I mention this is because Carolyn Green, in her love of the Targhee sheep and breeding and developing her own flock, also founded Sweetgrass Wool, which was known for selling Targi top to fiber artists. And I believe she had a range of products for fiber artists from Targi sheep that was raised around her. So in digging further, of course, where is this sweetgrass wool today? Well, in 2014, sweetgrass wool was acquired by Christine Vejar, the proprietress of A Verb for Keeping Warm. I tried to trace the line farther and see what has become of sweetgrass wool, specifically the Targi fiber. I haven't seen anything past 2014. So it sounds like there was some product that Christine sold. And hey, you guys might know better than me. Where did it go? What happened to sweetgrass wool after Verb for Keeping Warm acquired it? I am terribly curious. But anyway, Christine, through her blog, has some really cool posts about a trip that she took out to Montana to visit Carolyn. So if you want to have a glimpse into the Montana life, check them out. So thank you, Christine, for making those posts. I had a lot of fun reading through those. Okay, we're going to circle back now to Joseph and Annie. When I had the concept to spin natural colored fine wool into merino, I had to get my hands on some natural colored fine wool. I had lots of colored wool, but I didn't have any fine wool. And I wanted it to be fine wool to be compatible with the merino. So I did a little research and I found a Targi farm very close to me. I was surprised how close. It was right over the water in Everett. And at first I thought, no, this can't be right. Everett's a city. There's not a Targi farm in Everett. So to get there, I have to take a ferry and then it's like 5 miles, maybe 10 at the most, to this farm. I called Dale and Elaine Wilson at Glengyle Farm, and they cordially invited me to come out and see their farm. And I was thrilled and excited and also really confused, because even on my way there, I was in the city. And my GPS was telling me that I was just a couple blocks away. And here, sure enough, I turn a corner and I went from urban development to gazing over the Snohomish River Valley. And it literally, you look behind you and there's the city, look in front of you and there's the Snohomish River Valley. So I pulled in and of course I had to ask, how long has this farm been here? And immediately Elaine started telling me about how this whole area used to be dairy farms. And as the city grew and developed, they just started taking land. And they were notified that the city was building a road. They had no say in it whatsoever. And so their farm, which at one time was a large dairy farm, now has a city road cutting it in half or partial. I don't know what the percentage is, but their barn is on one side of the road and their field is on the other. And that just seems unfair, you know, but I know that's how it goes when urban development bumps against that agrarian lifestyle. You know, change happens, and here's an example of it. So as I got to know Dale and Elaine, I was just thrilled to have an opportunity to purchase their wool. And the way they tell it to me, they've been shepherding for 45 years. And in the beginning, they had the same kind of sheep that everybody had. They had down wool or long wool. And where they set themselves apart is they found out that hand spinners had an interest in buying fleece. So they started looking for sheep that would be dual purpose and also give them a high value product to sell to hand spinners, a high value wool product, right? So when they decided to make changes in their flock, they went to the fall sale held at the USDA Sheep Experiment Station in Du Bois, Idaho. And they came home with a Targi ram and 3 Targi ewes. And that was the beginning of their Targi development in their flock. So as I said before, they were using colored ewes to produce crossbred lambs. And what we have benefited from today is this gorgeous targi. I suppose you would call it a targi cross. Beautiful, natural colored targi wool. So you can imagine they've been shepherding for 45 years. They're kind of winding down and their flock is becoming smaller and more manageable. And I hear this a lot. So many farms have to go through this change and the next generation is going to innovate in their own way and respond to the agricultural needs or not, you know, whatever happens. But I've had to find other local farms that produce a fine wool that we can use in Joseph and Annie because there's just simply not enough from this one particular farm anymore. But as long as they have, sheep will be buying their wool. It's fantastic. And we're so grateful to have a relationship with these farmers who live so close to us. Hey, do you want to get your hands on some of this Joseph and Annie yarn I've been talking about? Head over to our website, AbundantEarthFiber.com, and place an order. We'll ship it the same day or the next day, and free shipping within the United States if you order $60 or more. We've got a lovely batch of pepper going on right now, and I believe the cinnamon batch that we're into right now is almost gone, but we've got lots of pepper, so go stock up. All right, I have a little bonus story for you. Thanks to the Fleece and Fiber Source book, which tipped me off to the namesake, Targi. And it just briefly says in the source book that the name Targi comes from a Bannock Chief Indian named Chief Targi. And that's all it said. And I just had to know more because it bothers me that I don't know more of the stories behind the native names that surround me. Even in my area, there's so much Coast Salish history and I claim ignorance. I don't know a lot of it and that really bothers me. So here I thought this was an opportunity for me to find out the story behind the name Targi. This story comes from an article written by Fred Thompson in the Teton Valley Magazine and it's called The Targi Enigma. It's published by Powder Mountain Press. And I felt that it was very well researched and I'm going to have to admit it was a little hard to, it's hard to read these stories. I understand why I wasn't told these stories more in school growing up. They are hard to hear and they're hard to make sense of. So this is one of those stories that is difficult to hear and difficult to make sense of, but it is the story behind the name. So being uncomfortable doesn't seem like a good reason not to tell the story. Therefore, I will do my best to relay the story, but I recommend reading the article for yourself if you want to hear it in more full. Okay. Chief Targi was actually known as Chief Taggy. It's like Targi without the R. The native tribes, late 19th century, relied mostly on spoken language. So there is some confusion about which Targi we're talking about. There were possibly subsequent chiefs named in honor of the original. So there is an assumption being made as to which one it is. But nonetheless, here is the story of Chief Taggy, who we now call Targi, which doesn't seem fair or make sense to anybody, but that's what it is. Nobody remembers the first person who suggested naming the National Forest, Targi National Forest. It was named in 1908, and the reason for choosing that name or who inspired it is lost. Brigham D. Madsen is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Utah. A bulk of this article is credited to his research, and I understand he spent a great deal of his life, much of his career, reading and studying and researching correspondence from early white settlers, newspaper accounts, military records, journals, and civilians. And his work is strongly reflected in this article. Chief Taggi was known as a peacekeeper. The Bannock Indian tribe was known as warriors. And so he went against the grain of his tribe's tradition in trying to find a peaceful way forward or possibly just survival. He became chief of the Bannock Indian tribe in 1865. And this was right in the middle of the settlers moving out west, crossing the California and Oregon trails, tearing up Indian land, bringing thousands and thousands of head of livestock across the plains. One record indicated that soldiers stationed would commonly see 100 trains go by a day. The westward movement of white settlers displaced native tribes, caused devastation, new illnesses, endless conflict, and unspeakable destruction. Taggi was not new to this conflict. He had been watching this conflict unfold for years before he became chief of his tribe. In fact, just 2 years prior, one of the neighboring tribes, the Shoshone, who had been known as generally one of the more friendly tribes, had started attacking white settlers because they could no longer endure the hardships of the white encroachment. So in the winter of 1863, in response to the increased raids by the Shoshone Indians, the U.S. Army sent a force led by Colonel Patrick Connor to punish them. The result was a Bear River Massacre. Near what is now Preston, Idaho, the Army attacked a camp of Shoshones, killing more Native Americans than any other battle in U.S. history. This was the context in which Chief Taggi had to lead his people. He and the other chiefs had to decide the fate of their family and friends in this context. They were proud, they were brave, they were warriors, and yet they were up against a foe that never lost. According to records, we believe the Bannock Indian tribe under Chief Taggi probably never were more than 1,000. A lot of them probably looked forward to war. But maybe it was the Bear River Massacre that caused Chief Taggi to choose a different path. He believed that negotiating for peace, settling for a permanent homeland assigned by the settlers, was better than the consequences of war against this foe that ultimately always won. The previous chief had signed a treaty, the Soda Springs Treaty, in 1863, wherein the Bannocks promised not to hurt travelers crossing their land, and in exchange, they would get money and goods, supplies, compensating them for the damages that had already been done to their pastures. The promised supplies never showed up, or they were delivered late, or they were held in locations so arduous for the Bannocks to reach that it was nearly impossible. In August 1867, Chief Taggi, frustrated, met with Idaho Governor D.W. Ballard. And according to research done by Madsen, this is, quote, attributed to Chief Taggi, directed to the governor. "The white people have come into my country and have not asked my consent. Why is this? And why have no persons talked to me before? I have never known what the white people wanted me to do. I have never killed white people who were passing in my country. What you say to me, I shall never forget. All Bannock Indians will obey me." The persecution continued. Promises failed. At one point, white settlers began herding pigs on the Camas Prairie, which had been promised the Bannocks. but they argued that the treaty allowed Native Americans access to the Kansas Prairie, which turns out to have been a clerical error. Blatant disregard for Native American welfare is remarkable in this story because it's balanced by the words of the agents assigned to look after the Native tribes, who all describe Chief Taggi as a most reliable, excellent, prudent counselor in moderation, patience, endurance. At one point, one of the Indian agents, so frustrated with the lack of supplies that had been promised and were not being provided, he spent his own personal money to purchase supplies for the tribe. Even white settlers pressured the government to treat the Bannocks more fairly, according to Madsen's research. And M.A. Carter of Soda Springs wrote, "The Bannocks have been and are now on the most friendly terms. At a treaty over 2 years ago between General Connor and the Bannock Indians, many obligations were undertaken which have never in any degree been carried into effect." By the summer of 1870, Taggi had shown endless patience, but he'd had enough, and his people had had enough. He demanded that the terms of the original treaty be honored, or he would wage war. Immediately, a partial distribution of relief supplies arrived. But sadly, this was the last action that Taggi carried out on behalf of his people, because the following summer, when the Bannocks returned from their buffalo hunt, it was learned that Taggi had died in the winter of 1870. As I said, this is not an easy story, and I don't really know how to make sense of it. But it is the story behind the name. Maybe when a solution is not available, we can look for progress. And when progress is too frustrating, we can just try understanding. That does it for this episode. Don't forget to visit us at the Fiber Lab next time you're on Whidbey Island. And if you'd like to get your hands on some of that Joseph and Annie DK Waite special batch, don't forget, mark your calendars for February 29th, 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Hey, you can show your support for Modern Wool by shopping sustainable small batch yarns on our website, AbundantEarthFiber.com. I'm Lydia Christiansen. Thanks so much for listening. One time I was out giving a presentation to a guild, a knitter's guild. And after my presentation, people ask questions or they want to talk or whatever. Anyway, this one lady came up to me and she said, "So when you record your podcast, are you just like standing in a dark room?" And I thought that was kind of a funny question. But I get what she was saying, which is like, where are you? Where are you doing this? Obviously, I'm not in the mill with machines running, or otherwise you would hear them, but I am at the mill. We have an office. So like on one, the wall in front of me on the other side of that is my carding room. And our team has gone through a lot of changes this past year. And one of those is that my full-time assistant, Leah, who has helped me with a lot of the mill work, has decided to move on. And we're happy for her. We're so grateful for her and excited to see what she does next. But now that means I get to take back over that role. And I'm just loving it so much. So having the podcast recording studio sort of thing set up here in the office at the mill is really convenient for me to get back there and work the mill for a bit and then step aside and do a little recording. So anyway, for those of you wondering, where am I? I'm at the mill. I'm in the office and I'm standing in a little recording booth that Alan made. He's good at making things. So he made this little recording booth for us. And he's the one that does all the post-processing. His skill set is really in line with that. And so he and I produce the show.